This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Nationally and in Ohio, the high school graduation rate has shown a lot of improvement since 2001. But that doesn't mean all is well. Millions of students across the country are still dropping out each year. I recently spoke with founder and CEO of Civic Enterprises and vice chair of the Service Year Alliance at the Aspen Institute, John Bridgeland, and Beachacres Parenting Center president and CEO Jim Mason about the reasons teens drop out of school and to look at some of the programs that are proving successful at keeping students in school. Jim and John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
Happy to be here.
So, John, what is the trend with the graduation rate nationally?
So after what was called the human capital century from 1876 to about the 1970s, we were building a secondary and post-secondary system that was the envy of the world and really meeting our social and individual and economic needs. We've had about 30 years of flatlining high school graduation rates from the 1970s to 2000. Encouragingly, since 2001, the national graduation rate has increased from about 71% to 84%, which means that 3 million more students have graduated from high school rather than dropping out, with huge consequences to them, their communities, and our economy. And interestingly, African Americans and Latino students have had the most significant gains in high school graduation rates, showing that this is not a chronically unfixable problem of poverty, but that in communities across the country that are getting focused and organized, even the most vulnerable students who live in desperate poverty can have better gains.
John, how is Ohio doing? What's the trend here?
So Ohio is interestingly, went from about – now, the data was a little, you know, different. There were estimates, but in the 50 to 60 percentile. So imagine going to a school where half your class is dropping out. Think about the culture that creates in a school setting and the peer pressure for other students to make those same choices. But encouragingly, Ohio's gone from about 50 to 55% to 83%, so almost at the national rate of gain. And in urban centers around the country, it's not been as significant, and there's still a lot of work to do.
Jim, what about Cincinnati?
Happy to say Cincinnati is above the curve in Ohio. In the last 5 years, we've had an increase in the rate from 64 to 73%. And that's a 9% increase, which is the highest of any urban school in the state. So we have a lot to be proud of, and there's been a lot of work that's gone into achieving that, but still a long way to go.
When we talk about the dropout rate, John, are we talking about just high school graduates or, high school dropouts, or does that figure also include middle school students as
well? So it's interesting. You talk to teachers and they can tell you that they say, you know, they can identify kids in kindergarten and first grade who are starting to exhibit signs of real worry. And in fact, one of the innovations in the last decade has been the creation of early warning systems that are highly predictive of whether a student will drop out many years later. Things like, what's your attendance? Are you, you know, chronically absent? Are you absent more than 10 to 15 to 20 days a year? Do you have repeated behavior infractions and problems in the school? And then course performance in reading and math. So those are the early signs of trouble that then schools and communities try to intervene against. But the way the graduation rates are calculated, it's a four-year rate. So the incoming ninth grade, and then 4 years later, are they on track and do they actually complete their diploma? And there we've seen, you know, tremendous progress across the country in terms of boosting those rates.
What are some of the reasons students are dropping out?
So interestingly, back in 2004, the Gates Foundation came to us and said, could you help us put the dropout issue on the national map? And we said, well, we're not sure. So we went away and did research and discovered there was data dating back to 1870 on graduation rates, but that nobody had ever talked.
That's surprising. 1870.
Yeah, 1870. So when they started to track it, but nobody had ever talked to the customers, to the young people themselves, to understand, you know, why did they make this decision to drop out? So we did in 25 communities across the country, big places like L.A. and Boston, but also rural areas like St. Clairsville, Ohio. And what was interesting was that it sort of debunked the stereotype. These weren't a bunch of young people who, you know, couldn't make it academically. The leading reason for dropping out was they didn't see a connection between what they wanted to be in life, and they had huge dreams. They wanted to be doctors, lawyers. One girl in Philly in our focus group said, I want to be an astrophysicist. I was inspired by the NASA space program. And tragically, 20 minutes later in that interview, we learned that she was working the street. She was literally a prostitute on the streets of Philadelphia.
Oh, wow.
And it was at that moment that our group said, you know, we're going to do everything in our power to lift up the voices of these kids and all this potential. They're not problems to be solved. They're potential to be fulfilled. And so if we can do better in knowing their names, caring for them, knowing their interests, and then connecting what they want to be to learning in the school, we're going to do a lot better in terms of boosting their rates.
Jim, tell what are some of the programs that Beach Acres is working on with Cincinnati Public Schools?
Well, I think, first of all, Mark, getting back to what John was saying about how do we get to the point where kids are showing these early warning signs, even in early grades, and having a challenge at passing reading tests, we find that how do kids get here like that in the first place? And here we are at a point in our history where the world's changing so rapidly and the jobs are changing out there for people. They require more critical thinking and creativity skills and that type of thing. But kids are growing up in environments where it's very difficult to get that in the communities. You know, we have a high child poverty rate here, one of the highest in the country. We've got the Child Poverty Collaborative working on that, which is great. But we see all the time kids at very early on, preschool and elementary school, they're just coming to school with the weight of the world on their shoulders because they're hungry, because they aren't sure where they're going to go after school, because they're worried about what's going on in their families. Maybe there's some stress or father's gone or there may be substance use involved or just the parental challenges that they're having with trying to work three jobs and get to those. So these little guys are coming in with an awful lot on their minds, and I think these are some of the root causes that get to the behavior problems that kids have at early ages and inability to get along with each other and focus on their work. So what we're doing is partnering with the good news about Greater Cincinnati. We see a child's education in the light of the whole ecosystem of the child's life, if you will. You know, the old African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. So that is true in education, and the ecosystem is in any community is made up of the school itself, the school building with the teachers and the parents and the faculty and the kids. It's also made up of the environment around them, so the community partners, the mental health, the access to other resources, food insecurity, and so on. And in Cincinnati, we have some few national exemplar resources out there, community learning centers. We've got 24 health clinics in schools. We have the Mind piece, which is dedicated to improving mental health of kids in schools. It's got 14 agencies like ours that are members of it. So we have sort of a focus on integrating community resources into schools, which has helped a lot. When a child comes to school and has a health problem, they can access resources there. When they're hungry, the school lunch program helps. We're beginning to put these community-based resources into schools in ways that are more coordinated than they have ever been. And the school actually becomes, in the case of community or learning centers, they were set up to be a hub for community resources like Beach Acres to go in and to access. Now, that's a very, very important part of the issue because when a child is identified as having a problem through their behavior, through poor grades or whatever, we want to be able to see that child and get them the help as immediately as we possibly can through community-based resources. Now, the other piece, and this is where we are partnering with Children Inc., Mayerson Academy, and some others, is on the whole part of the social-emotional learning John referenced, where
And I wonder if you could explain little bit about what social-emotional learning
is.
I'll just say
a word that Jim signaled through Beach Acres three decades ago to me that these schools had been set up in a manufacturing model really to focus on academics and instruction. And yet all these young people, as Jim just mentioned, were walking into the school with, you know, their lives. And it could be trauma. It could be hunger. It could be homelessness. It could be disruption in the home. It could be a whole suite of issues that are really social and emotional. And what's exciting is from the Cincinnati Public Schools My Tomorrow Initiative, actually in preparation for this talk with you today, Mark, I reached out to the chief in Ohio, Paolo Damaris, and I said, what are you proudest of in terms of what the state is doing? And he said, in Cleveland, they've embraced social and emotional development, where from the Cleveland plan that Kasich and Jackson put in place to the collective bargaining agreement to the planning centers and schools that say to a traumatized kid, you're not going to be suspended or expelled. We're actually going to sit you down and we're going to work with you. And you're going to help not only accept responsibility for what's going on in your life, we're going to help you manage through it. That's a breakthrough. Because otherwise, kids get the message that schools are unwelcoming places and hostile places, and yet another signal that they're not welcome. In Cincinnati, he said, in Cincinnati, it's this My Tomorrow initiative where they're making a real commitment to social and emotional development of children. And then the other encouraging part of it, which I understand Dr. Mitchell is doing here, is our dropout study showed that what the kids wanted most was a connection between learning and an eventual career. And they often didn't see those connections. And I understand My Tomorrow is putting at the earliest grades, kids in first and second and third grades are starting to think about goals and ambitions and what they want to become and what's the relevance of the learning that they're doing in the school to those career pathways. And I'll just say a final word on this. A council of distinguished scientists just came together from all across the country and presented the evidence to this national commission that I'm on social, emotional, and academic development at the Aspen Institute. And it's overwhelming. High-quality social and emotional learning programs increase attendance, achievement, graduation rates, college enrollment, college completion, and attachment to the workforce. And frankly, I've never seen kind of a larger, more significant rocket booster in education reform than the sea change we're starting to see across the country that's moving low-performing schools to higher-performing schools, which is looking at the school system as an ecosystem to support and cultivate the whole child, not just the academic dimension of learning.
Yeah. How are the schools in general? Let's take Cincinnati as an example. How is Cincinnati doing at integrating that with academics?
So, for example, you asked about what we're doing specifically, and in partnership with Children Inc., we have developed, and Meyerson Academy, we've developed a model that looks at an entire school building, okay, as a system. And instead of just looking at the kids who are having trouble, we're looking at the entire student body with universal prevention services. We're looking at the teachers and the parents. So we're including every stakeholder in that school building and helping them to shift from a mindset of focusing on fixing broken kids to identifying what natural gifts are and mindfully attending to those. And it's not just the gifts of the kids, but it's the gifts of the teachers and the parents. Because the key ingredient in the success of a school is the quality of teaching that goes in. The pressure on individual classroom teachers is enormous, and they feel this, you know, need to do well on the test and to get the kids marching in the right direction. And the burnout rate is very high. And one of the things that I credit Dr. Mitchell with, too, in her focus as a new superintendent, is on the care and well-being of those teachers. And how do I help a teacher go into the classroom able to focus on the overall whole child, as John said, the social-emotional part as well as the academic part? Because we know from brain science that when we have trauma to our brains, especially as little kids, because the brain's 90% developed by the time you're 3 years old. So when you have that adverse childhood experience of the violence in the home or the community or family disruption or those kinds of things, poverty, it affects the development of the brain and therefore the learning capability of the child. And we know what heals that brain is a nurturing, safe, protective, friendly environment that sees who you are and what your natural gifts are and focuses on those. So the whole idea of the social-emotional development says, you are a unique human being, you're your own snowflake, I value you, how do I help you develop those skills? And we've developed tools. Very specifically, what we use in this program called the Character Effect that we're pilot testing in 8 schools this year. We provide training to the teachers, first of all, to help them identify their own strengths. We use the VIA character development instrument. You go to viacharacter.org, viacharacter.org, and people can take it, fill it out, and you'll see what your top 24, what your gifts are. And then the teachers see that in themselves, and then the students take it, and they see it in their children. It changes the conversation in the classroom. And they can see that a child who's up and ambitious and kind of running around the class, they're creative or they have a lot of zest for life. And it reframes in a teacher's mind from that's a bad kid to there's a kid with zest. How do I help him learn to channel his zest in the classroom?
So it's about developing an understanding of your own strengths.
That's exactly right. And so when the teacher understands her strengths or his strengths, they bring that to the class. And that just awareness of being mindful of them in the moment. And for example, some people's strength might be love. Well, if a teacher appreciates that she's a naturally loving person, she's going to bring more of that love to the classroom because she knows it's a gift she has to give those kids. And then by seeing those strengths in the kids, you can actually, we have coaches in the schools where they actually work with the teachers on not only implementing the curriculum, but also leveraging their own strengths to work manage child behavior during the school instead of focusing on the problems.
This also ties back to the dropout issue, which is when the most compelling evidence of actually what works in keeping kids on track and engaged and to not only complete high school but be prepared for college is teacher self-efficacy, the degree to which a teacher has the confidence and the skills and the belief to be able to improve the achievement of these young kids. And so understanding who they are, their names, what their interests are, their ambitions, that kid that is active and alive and, you know, has zest is not labeled as some disruptive kid. And so it makes a big difference. The other thing I want to say is schools can't do this alone. And what's interesting about Cincinnati is with the Strive Partnership, which takes this holistic model across, you know, nursery school or actually in the womb into the workforce. You've got educators and nonprofit leaders like Beach Acres. You've got business leaders all and policymakers all working together to see our kids on track every step of the way, and what can we do to make sure that this school-to-work pipeline is actually more effective? Because another thing that's interesting is the public media has played a huge role across the country. They created an initiative called American Graduate, where they raised awareness of the dropout epidemic, which was not on the national radar screen. They used their convening power in more than 100 communities to bring leaders together to say, what are your plans of action to address it? And then they covered, like, you know, both problems and challenges in a really tough way together with solutions. And now they're just launching American Graduate 3 that takes us beyond the high school dropout challenge and says, you know, how are we educating kids beyond high school into post-secondary and then into the workforce?
You know, you talk about the schools and the community working on this issue. It's a huge issue.
Yeah.
Is there one more element to this? Parents?
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad absolutely. You brought that up because that was just about what I was going to sort of raise as a parenting center. The number one correlation between with a child's academic well-being is the parents' involvement in their education. And that does not necessarily mean going to PTA meetings, but it is having an expectation that a child will be educated and will come home and do their homework. It's keeping up on what their expectations in school are and making sure that they're meeting them behaviorally and so forth. It's being a partner with the teacher for the child's well-being, which is why our whole focus is on, in the school, the child and their social-emotional skills, the teacher and theirs, and the parent and theirs, bringing them all together. And so one of the things we've created in schools and in all these schools that we're in is having the parents know what their natural strengths are, bring it all together for a conversation. We have parent events where the parents are coming to play bingo for developing your strengths with the teachers and with the kids. We identify parent leaders in schools to help them organize the other teachers, other kids, and bring them or other parents and bring them to the schools. And then also mentors, because there are a lot of parents who themselves had poor educational experiences. Maybe they didn't graduate from high school. Their own trauma as a child may have gotten in the way of their own educations. So they are not that much of a resource to their own children with their educations. And our through our mentoring program, peer support program with parents, we can get them access to resources. And the other aspect of this, too, is reading is such a huge piece. Obviously, if you learn to read, you can read to learn. And many homes don't have books in them because the parents didn't grow up reading or weren't read to as kids. So we just got a $20,000 grant from Scripps and WCPO to buy books and disseminate them to schools. And we just had a big celebration down at Euler Elementary. We had a book fair. And every kid in Euler Elementary, Clifford was down there, the dog, and it was a grand old time. It was fabulous. And every kid went home with books. They were so excited to go home with his books. And, you know, our whole piece as a parenting center is go home and have the child sit on the parent's lap and read the book to the parent, or have the parent read to the child. Because what really happens there is you're not just learning to read. You are on your mother's lap. You are bonding. And with the feedback we get from parents is enormous about the power of having that child. They never sat on anybody's lap. Now they got their kids sitting on their lap. And that bonding that occurs between that parent and the child is healing for whatever trauma the child had. The child will be better prepared to go to school, which is another one of the huge roles that the parent provides, is that.
I would just add, Jim and I actually, interestingly, about 8 years ago, partnered on a nationally representative survey of parents all across the United States, because the data was overwhelming that parents are the most significant factor in every step of the child's development in life. And the most significant in-school factor, of course, is the teacher. But we also discovered this complete disconnect between many parents and schools. A lot of parents felt welcome and engaged in kindergarten and elementary school. But as their young child started to go through middle and high school, particularly by high school, they felt unwelcome, some cases kind of intimidated, didn't have a way in, kind of an access point into high school. And so Jim, through Beach Acres, and I know in Kentucky, have done a lot of innovative things, including through technology. And even if you're a low-income family, don't have a computer at home, you can go to your public library and you can go online and you can see, you know, what's my child's schedule? What are the homework assignments? How can we get my child more help with homework? You know, what are the big events that are coming up? And so schools are doing a lot of innovative things to actually connect parents back into the school and offer them a way in.
What about the challenges facing homeless students? Have we seen progress
in that
area? I'm
glad you raised that, because we've disaggregated data by race, ethnicity, income level, students with disabilities, English language learners in this country. And so we can tell in every community in every state where Black and Latino and white and Asian low-income kids are doing, students with disabilities. But we discovered just in the last few years that there are 1.3 million homeless students in the United States, and that they have the lowest graduation rates of any subgroup of any of students. And interestingly, because there's so much stigma and fear, these young people don't want to self-identify that they're homeless, because then they think they'll be shut out by their peers or viewed differently. And in fact, in some cases, they're nervous that they're going to be torn apart from their families. And so we are just launching a campaign, interestingly, in March. I've been working with, again, public media to put homeless students on the national map. In Deer Park Independent School District in Texas, 100% of homeless students are graduating from high school. In Tukwila and Spokane, Washington, and in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the rate of progress in increasing graduation rates for homeless students is higher than for other students. So my point is that there are actually communities and states in the country that are doing it well and are doing the right things to keep homeless students on track. So if we can do it in Deer Park and Tukwila and Spokane, we can do it anywhere.
What's the goal, John? Where would you like to see the graduation rate end up?
So it's interesting, Mark. Three U.S. presidents, George H.W. Bush in 89, Bill Clinton in the context of Goals 2000, George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush in the context of NCLB, and President Obama set the same graduation rate of a 90% high school graduation rate. And under the first three presidents, the challenge came and went, and we didn't make all that much progress. But encouragingly, in the last decade or so, we're up to 84%, up from the 71% to 84%. And so the goal is at least a 90% high school graduation rate by the class of 2020. and for all students subgroups. It can't just be the wealthier kids or the white kids. It needs to be all students. And I think reaching that goal would have huge effects, not only to those individuals, but our society, our economy. And given the state of our civic health in this country, the lowest levels of social trust, institutional trust, a doubling of hate groups since the 1990s, all sorts of lowest levels of volunteering rates and even voting rates since the 1960s, we have to think beyond our economic gains and how are we cultivating in these young people a sense of responsibility to give back to their community and their country and to become not spectators but active citizens who also can check power in government, who also can address issues in a way that's informed and makes a difference in the life of those communities.
John, Jim, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Mark, can I just put a shameless plug in for something before we get off the air? We have a positive parenting series coming up, and I'd like to invite people on February the 15th from 6 to 8 at the Mayerson Academy in Coryville to hear a presentation from Laura Jewell on resilient kids, raising positive children. And so call Beachacres at 231-6630 or go on our website, beachacres.org, to learn more.
I'm coming.
Founder and CEO of Civic Enterprises and Vice Chair of the Service Year Alliance at the Aspen Institute, John Bridgeland, and Beachacres Parenting Center President and CEO, Jim Mason. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.